Blog Talk Radio.
For radio as secular as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We'll talk about why nothing fails like prayer.
Then Princeton anthropology professor Agustin Fuentes will join us to talk about why we believe.
And we'll explain the evolutionary origin of belief.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The announcement by China and the United States that they've pledged to work together to cut harmful emissions this decade has been welcomed by UN Chief Antonio Guterres. Reacting to the surprise declaration on Wednesday by the two top economies at the COP26 summit in Glasgow, the UN Secretary General said that tackling the climate crisis requires international cooperation and solidarity, and this is an important step in the right direction. His comments came after China's climate envoy Xi Xianhua and his counterpart from the US, John Kerry, told reporters that their countries would work together to meet the goals of the 2015 Paris Agreement, including by sharing technological expertise. As the global gathering draws to an end in Scotland, negotiators are busy drafting a final outcome document of the conference, which is expected to be released over the weekend. UN humanitarians said on Thursday that they've delivered aid to people stranded on the Belarus-Poland border. In a tweet, the head of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, Filippo Grandi, said that the priorities were to prevent loss of life and move people to safer locations in Belarus. Mr. Grandi welcomed the access granted to aid teams from his agency and the International Organization for Migration, IOM, adding that UNHCR stood ready to help find solutions to the crisis, which has seen large numbers of migrants and asylum seekers mass at the frontier between the two countries. The development follows UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet's appeal on Wednesday for immediate humanitarian access, after she described the situation as intolerable. Amid plunging winter temperatures and reports that a child had died, Ms. Bachelet insisted that hundreds of men, women and children must not be forced to spend another night in freezing weather without adequate shelter, food, water and medical care. To Africa now, where the UN Health Agency has said that diabetics are four times more likely to die from COVID-19 than those who do not have the disease. The alert from the World Health Organization, WHO, follows analysis of 13 African countries where there was a more than 10% fatality rate among patients with diabetes and the coronavirus, compared with 2.5% for COVID-19 patients overall. Diabetes impairs our ability to produce or process insulin, which is needed to prevent a dangerous rise in blood sugar. The disease causes inflammation and poor blood circulation, which increase the risk of complications, including death, from COVID-19. An estimated 24 million people live with diabetes in Africa today, and this number is expected to nearly double by 2045. Africa is also the region with the highest number of people who do not know their diabetic status, with an estimated 7 in 10 not knowing if they have the disease. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and happy Veterans Day to all you atheists and other non-believers in foxholes.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This is the November 11th, 2021 edition of Free Thought Radio. Grant Blaschka, again, is engineering, producing the show in the Stephen Yule Friendly Atheist Studio in Free Thought Hall. That's the building of the National Offices of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We do many other things. We have other media, newspaper, radio shows, but we primarily work to keep religion out of government with a team of attorneys. We litigate, We try to end violations through education and persuasion, and we also educate you, the public, about the views of those of us who are non-religious. And if you're a member of FFRF, lovely. If not, we would be delighted to send you a sample of our newspaper, Free Thought Today. It's available as a hard copy or PDF and a brochure about our 40-plus years of achievements as a tax-exempt nonprofit with 35,000 members in North America.
A nonprofit.
Nonprofit. So you can look us up at FFRF.org.
Today in the second half of the show, we're going to ask, why do people believe? Our guest will be the Princeton anthropology professor, Agustin Fuentes. He's the author of the book, Why We Believe. He will give us his explanation of the evolutionary origin of belief.
And why do people believe in prayer when it's obvious that nothing fails like prayer, my mother's favorite motto? In a few minutes, we'll hear Dan address that question in the song, Nothing Fails Like Prayer.
This Sunday is the anniversary of the birth of the composer Aaron Copland. He was born November 14, 1900. Aaron Copland came from a Jewish family, but he was neither religious nor observant. Copland, who was gay, lived and died as a non-believer. He specified that his funeral service, if any, should be non-religious. He died at age 90 in 1990. Listen for some of Copland's music today, including Prairie Journal, Circus Music, Threshing Machines, and Happy Ending from The Red Pony.
On our TV show, Free Thought Matters, our guest this week is Debbie Allen, the executive director of the Secular Coalition for America. The Freedom From Religion Foundation is one of 20 national secular organizations who band together in this secular coalition to lobby the government for science, reason, and secular values.
And on that show, we asked Debbie why it is important for the national secular groups to come together in this effort.
The benefit to us as a lobbying organization going to the Hill is that we're taking with us the power of the coalition, the numbers involved in the coalition, and also the various groups in the coalition. It makes a big difference to a Congress member to see that there's actually a military association involved, or a Jewish organization involved, or a Hispanic organization. It lets certain people know that, in fact, those groups exist, and that there are non-theists in foxholes, for example.
Yes, very timely to play that on Veterans Day.
And we have a monument to non-theists in foxholes right here at our building.
Yes, we do. You can see the entire Free Thought Matters interview with Debbie Allen this Sunday on broadcast TV in a variety of cities, or you can go right now and watch it on YouTube. We release it every Thursday, and if you want to see how to watch it in Chicago, Denver, Houston, L.A., Madison, Wisconsin, Minneapolis, New York, Phoenix, Portland, Sacramento, Seattle, D.C., and San Francisco, go to FFRF.org under the news link. Look for the Free Thought Matters drop-down, and it will give you the different call numbers, the stations, and the times, Sunday mornings.
And as Annie Laurie said, you can go to YouTube and see FFRF's Free Thought Matters channel playlist there on YouTube.
This week on our Ask an Atheist, which is our Facebook Live video program, FFRF Director of Strategic Response Andrew Seidel talks with Corey Douglas and ex-minister Justin Gentry, who are co-hosts of the podcast Go Home Bible, You're Drunk. It's on the Irreverent Network, and it's about ex-evangelicals.
And during the show, what is an ex-evangelical, Andrew asked Corey Douglas.
The term ex-evangelical came around, it was coined by Blake Chastain, but we wanted like a language, right, for the people who are leaving evangelical spaces and kind of like this conservative religious American ideology that is so prevalent in our country. And now it seems to have kind of taken off as a label, and evangelicals are a little bit upset at this point that ex-evangelical is a thing, as they should be. I'm fine with this. But yeah, it's just basically a label for people who have left, like, white American evangelicalism.
I mean, that's kind of like ex-Mos, ex-Mormons.
Ex-Mormons.
So you can see that show archived on FFRF's YouTube channel. You can look for the Ask an Atheist playlist. You can also tune in live for the show. It's not going to be a live show next week, Dan. It will be a rerun because we're all going to be on our way to Boston.
But most
the week
Wednesdays.
After, most Wednesdays, it is live noon central.
So, to the news.
Well, first we want to, boo at the 27 governors and states that are foolishly, recklessly, and religiously suing the Biden administration over the new OSHA laws that are enforcing vaccination mandates for companies with 100 or more employees. The Biden administration is doing the right thing. It is following the science. People need to be mandated to vaccinate. It's what we are seeing works. And they are fighting it, and we saw a bad decision already out of the Fifth Circuit putting it in abeyance. And there is more trouble ahead. And, of course, many, many of the religionists who are suing for religious reasons, including answers in Genesis, because they have 100 employees.
The people who built the Noah's Ark.
Right. So the religious exemption issue is really brewing. FFRF will be stepping into that fray a little bit more, but it's a huge anti-science backlash. And speaking of anti-science, once again, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is condemning Arizona Governor Ducey for using COVID relief funds to spread COVID. Huh. Yes, he is defying the federal funding that he is getting that's supposed to be used to mitigate COVID, and he is using that money to kind of rob from the public schools and give that money to private schools. If you don't like a masking mandate in your Phoenix or your Arizona school, you can withdraw your children and use COVID money to go to a religious school that doesn't follow protocol on COVID.
What's wrong with that picture?
And the Treasury Department has gone after him, and then he's refusing to do anything about it. And if you are on our list in Arizona, you would have been asked to write an action alert against this to Governor Ducey, which hearing from constituents is so important. But this, you can't think of anything much more counterproductive and more wasteful than what Ducey is doing.
Our attorneys have been busy. We have 9 full-time attorneys and a big legal staff writing letters of complaint and filing lawsuits and filing amicus briefs, which are called friend of the court briefs. The Freedom From Religion Foundation is filing an appeals court brief on behalf of the Secular Student Alliance in support of an Indiana school district's actions to rein in discrimination against transgender students by a religious music teacher. Brownsburg High School music teacher John Klug was trying to avoid using the name of a transgender student. The school said he could call them by their last names. The parent of a transgender student noted that the teacher still called her child Miss, causing her child a lot of distress. Other students complained. The school corporation district revoked the last name policy, saying the school system... But then he sued, saying that the school system failed to accommodate him. His accommodation is more important than the feelings of the students, apparently.
And actually, the student ended up dropping out of the class and leaving the school because of the distress.
So we filed our brief on November the 7th on behalf of the Secular Student Alliance, who represent students in the school.
But speaking of discrimination against minorities, the Indiana School District refused FFRF's request to file that amicus brief on our own behalf. Our members, 11% are LGBTQ, our members support trans rights because we are an atheist agnostic group. Mm. We had to go in and file that on behalf of Secular Student Alliance. So when you can see the totem pole of social acceptance, non-believers are still at the bottom, even when we're on your side. The Freedom From Religion Foundation criticized the highly questionable act by a judge in the trial, the homicide trial ongoing right now, the big trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in Wisconsin, because the judge made a biblical reference.
And Rittenhouse, of course, is accused of killing those people during a protest.
Killing two and wounding another in Kenosha.
Judge Bruce Schroeder raised eyebrows when explaining the concept of hearsay to the jurors by citing the trial of Paul in the New Testament.
But when it gets into court, and this is actually referred to in the Bible, St. Paul, when he was put on trial, and he was a Roman citizen, he has rights that we share now as Americans. When they tried to put him on trial with evidence from which was being repeated by somebody who wasn't there and under oath, he said, "Where are the witnesses against me? I am a Roman, and I have a right to confront my accusers. They should be here." So it's an ancient rule.
St. Paul? The judge's fumbling explanation from Acts 25 was both confusing and unnecessary, since the legal concept of hearsay is very easy to explain without any reference to Scripture. And worse still, Schrader's explanation gives the false impression that America's secular laws are somehow based on the Bible, and of course they emphatically are not. We have a godless secular constitution.
But what's worse, the judge actually bungled the story. In Acts 25, Paul did not say what Judge Schroeder said he said. Paul's accusers were in fact present at the trial in Caesarea. They were Jews who were charging him with religious heresy because he said Jesus had risen from the dead. The issue, which was raised by the procurator Festus, not by Paul, was whether the Roman court had the authority or the knowledge to rule on a local religious dispute, or whether they should turn Paul over to the Jewish court down in Jerusalem. So he doesn't even know his Bible that he was quoting.
Yeah, and he's getting a lot of bad press for many other reasons right now. He deserves a raspberry there. And we also pointed out, it's so sorry to see this happen, that voters last week in Texas unwisely approved Prop 3. It's a ballot measure amending the state constitution to prohibit the state from limiting worship services for public health considerations, such as in the event of another pandemic or another wave. And very disappointing, because this could easily lead to preventable deaths in the future. And as we said in our release, deadly viruses don't care about your religious liberty. Texans can't claim to be pro-life. You know, they're the state banning abortion with this on the books.
We also complained about a Georgia member of Congress participating in a Ten Commandments ceremony, claiming that the Ten Commandments are the basis of American law. He went ahead and did that.
That was Representative Jody Heiss, a Republican from Georgia, right? Attended an event over a set of 9 historic documents that are prominently featured now in the Monticello City Hall, and it's all a ruse to get the Ten Commandments
there.
The
group it's sponsoring is pro-Ten Commandments. And by the way, those 9 documents omit an important document.
And what is that?
The U.S. Constitution itself is not even there as a foundation of American law. So we mentioned that we had sent a letter to Florida schools complaining
about a report
complaining about religion. And we also sent a letter to a specific school where a teacher there is proselytizing and putting up religious messages. It's the Blair Middle School in Broward County Schools. And some of them say, "Praise God, confess your sins, thank God, for God so loved the world." And so we're asking the school.
Yeah, really egregious. And if you go to our website and look at the press release, you can see a whole bunch of photographs what they're doing. It's outrageous.
That teacher is stepping over the line, using a public position to promote private religion. We did have a victory in court this week. A victory in letters. We don't always go to court. Sometimes we can just write a letter. And this was in Oklahoma. A high school in Tecumseh, Oklahoma, is now no longer proselytizing football players and students after we complained about it in defense of the Constitution. The players were required to attend a team prayer meeting on the school's football field while the coaches organized and led the prayer at the school-sponsored event. Their Facebook was promoting religion. Staff attorney for FFRF, Chris Lyne, wrote a letter to the schools asking them to investigate. The schools responded with what we call a constitutional touchdown. The superintendent has now instructed the removal of the religious messages on the school's official Facebook page and has spoken with the coaches to ensure that prayers are student-led, voluntary, and are held off district property. So that's some of the actions of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And we're going to take a break.
After the break, we're going to question why members of Congress and the President are attending or sending delegates to attend the National Prayer Breakfast when it is clear that nothing feels like prayer, and it is also clear that it is inappropriate. Then we'll hear Dan's song, Nothing Feels Like Prayer. After that, we'll talk with Princeton anthropologist Augustine Fuentes about his book, Why We Believe.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
Hi, I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
Margaret Sanger's motto was, no gods, no masters. This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation has a new campaign. We may have already reported that we have contacted a number of members of Congress asking them to boycott the next National Prayer Breakfast that usually happens in early February. And last week we also wrote President Biden, who has attended or spoken virtually. He attended and spoke virtually at the event this year, actually, and has attended in the past as vice president. We sent these letters to members of Congress and Biden because this is a pay-to-play political event with a very troubling constitutional history. It's a shadowy fellowship foundation known as the Family that organizes this. They are right-wingers. They are Christian nationalists. They are friendly with dictators around the world. It's not a very savory outfit, but they use this National Prayer Breakfast to do a lot of backdoor negotiating. We have seen how Trump used it. We've seen the spy, Maria Butina, an unregistered foreign agent with ties to Russia that was circulating. We've seen how the MyPillow CEO, Mike Lindell, credits his rise in relationship with former President Trump to being picked out of 12 people to pray with Ben Carson in a room at the National Prayer Breakfast.
But it sounds like, the name sounds like it's an official government, the National
Prayer
Breakfast.
That's another problem. They shouldn't be going to something that looks like it's run by Congress, and there's all kinds of entanglement. So that's our new campaign, and we think that it's very important to try to get, especially any of the progressive-minded individuals who go there, to stop going because it's lending credibility to it. They're being used. They're being exploited.
And besides that, nothing fails like prayer.
So we are going to listen to Dan's song. It's Nothing Fails Like Prayer.
The farmers pray for precipitation, and they say, in God we trust. Then along comes a drought and dries their crops out and turns their prayers into dust. The next time they need some assistance, they should take the advice of Mark Twain, who said it's better to check the weather report before you pray for rain. Nothing fails like prayer. Nothing fails like prayer. Use your mind and you will find that nothing fails like prayer. You reach the final week of the school year, but you haven't studied your best. So you stay up and cram for the final exam, then pray for God's help on the test. Then you answer the questions with assurance,
that the Lord will help you sail through. When the results are returned, what have you learned? God's no smarter than you. Nothing fails like prayer. Nothing fails like prayer. Use your mind and you will find that nothing fails like prayer. You buy 100 lottery tickets, then you ask the Holy Ghost to influence the gods to better your odds, because you deserve it the most. Then reality teaches you that lesson about hoping for heavenly grants. The success rate of prayer happens to fare no better than chance. How many centuries will it take us before we realize there are no magic forces in nature, no watchful eyes in the sky? A single plow is much more effective than 100 prayers a day. The hands that help are better far than lips that pray. Nothing fails like prayer. Nothing fails like prayer. Use your mind and you will find that nothing fails like prayer.
Cha-cha-cha. So that was inspired by Ann Gaylor's famous slogan, nothing fails like prayer. And I remember we would use it in every letter to public officials who were misusing their authority to pray as a government official. And some of our members started saying, we should put that on a bumper sticker. And she said, who would put that on their car? And it's still selling, those bumper stickers. And it's still one of our favorite mottos to invoke to erring public officials. And, of course, it also quoted Robert Ingersoll.
Well, and also quoted your mom, because she gave me that line, God's no smarter than you. And then you asked me to write the song, and I used your voice for the melody. So you and your mom are co-writers.
Well, you meant you had me say it. And then
you said it, and then I used the thing. So.
Yeah, I did not sing that.
So, you can hear the music by Aaron Copland. We're going to take a break. And after the break, we'll be talking with Princeton anthropologist Augustine Fuentes about his book, Why We Believe. I'm Dan Barker with co-host Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
Hello, this is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. Welcome back.
And I'm Dan Barker. Where did religion come from? Where did belief come from? Are they the same thing? Our guest today has an answer. Augustine Fuentes is an anthropologist and a primatologist at Princeton University. He's formerly the chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Notre Dame. He received his degrees, including a PhD in anthropology from UC Berkeley. He's been an explorer for the National Geographic and was recently awarded the inaugural Communication and Outreach Award from the American Association of Physical Anthropologists, the President's Award from the American Anthropological Association, and elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences.
Professor Fuentes' many books include The Creative Spark, How Imagination Made Humans Exceptional, Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You, Busting Myths About Human Nature, and Evolution of Human Behavior, that was published by Oxford University Press. He is also the editor-in-chief of the International Encyclopedia of Primatology.
So he knows what he's talking about. Augustine Fuentes' most recent book is Why We Believe, Evolution and the Human Way of Being. This book was the winner of the 2020 inaugural International Society for Science and Religion Book Prize in the field of science and religion. So, Agustin Fuentes, welcome to Free Thought Radio.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And we're talking to you from New Jersey now, where you are now working at Princeton. Is that right?
That is right. I am in New Jersey now, almost 2 years now.
So I love your book, Why We Believe. And to be very clear here, this book is not just about religion. It's about belief in general. So how would you define the word belief?
Well, I think that's such a good question, and just let me preface it by saying I think we undervalue humans and human evolutionary histories and human potentials by always saddling belief and religion together as one sort of common thing. So when I'm talking about belief, I'm talking about a broader capacity that has evolved over the last 2 million years in the human lineage, and that is the ability to combine our imagination, our experiences, our knowledges and creativity, and to imagine other possibilities or ideas or thoughts or contexts, and to fuse them together in such a way that they become so deeply held by us, so completely felt, even if they're not material or here and now, that they become part of our reality. So belief is this ability to cast our minds and our bodies and our societies in a particular direction so that becomes real for the people who believe it.
Well, I used to feel that way, too, when I was a strong evangelical believer, that it wasn't just an idea. It was like a part of who I was. So from what you say, the key here is imagination, which you're taking an evolutionary approach. Imagination is something that evolved. How did imagination then evolve? You connect it with tool making or some other early aspects of humanity?
Yeah, so a lot of organisms have this ability to sort of have mental representations. Right? That's common in the world. Things see something and they can draw up that memory in their mind, right? See something in the mind's eye. What humans have, and maybe a few other organisms, but we know that humans have this well, is something called detached representation. So humans can actually come up with something wholly internally that they've never seen, experienced, felt, or heard, right? And then combine that with things that they have experienced, felt, and heard. So this ability gives humans, or this capacity gives humans the ability to look at the world around them, to see materially how it is, what they've experienced, what's there that they can touch and grab, and at the same time imagine wholly new possibilities and either sort of perceive them into the environment or actually try to reshape the environment to make them real. And stone tools are an example of that, right? Some deep point in our ancestry, right, these early humans looked at rocks and figured out that inside that rock was another thing and that you can modify this rock to create it so they could see the tool inside the rock. And that's a very simple explanation, but over the last 2 million years, different kinds of use of tools and materials and incredibly complex social realities and manipulation of the environment and more sort of capacities for cultural change and art and expression all combined together to feed the possibility of imagination. And it's imagination, our ability to do detached representation, and this incredible social nature and collaborative nature of humans that produces this capacity to believe.
So let's talk about religion, though. Was religion evolved, or is it a cultural creation, or what's the difference between that?
There's actually no difference between those two things in the general sense, right? So here's one thing that I like to say, and I actually say this in the book. I make a big difference between religiousness and religion, right? The religiousness, right, here, and I'm drawing from Clifford Geertz and others, is this sort of ability to sort of in the human to experience the transcendent, to experience something that is not here and now, but experience it fully, really viscerally, right, to feel that sensation and to have that sensation change you or affect you in some way. All humans have that capacity. And we could talk about that. But religions themselves, right, are structured institutions, cultural organizations with theologies, histories, and sort of parameters and rules and regulations that are constructed and built and that engage this capacity for religiousness, this capacity to feel the transcendent realities or feel something that's not here and now, and that they formalize it and put it together. And I think the important thing here is that if we look at religions, right, the institution, the theology, the structures around that deploy or engage these experiences, we can look at them and we can find the archaeological, historical, and prehistorical records for when they emerged. And we can say, in all honesty and factually, that religion is very new, but humanity is quite old. And so then we have to figure out, how did this happen? What's the relationships? And I think this capacity for imagination, transcendence, and sort of this religiousness is much more, from my perspective, interesting than contemporary religions as, you know, theological institutional entities.
So it does look like religion is really recent. I mean, you know, cities are only, what, 6,000 years old, and agriculture,
yeah,
not before that. But so you just used a word, and
wait,
I'm sure
wait,
you...
Let me interrupt really quickly.
Okay.
So religions as we know them today, right? There's probably other kinds of ritual or other kinds of experiences and all that, but when I'm talking about religions, I'm talking about these sort of institutions with theology and histories and structures and those kinds of things. And we can show, you know, that in the last 8,000 years, pretty much everything that we consider a world religion or a mainstream religion has shown up in that time period and did not exist beforehand.
And it's recent because our species is probably 200,000 years, our modern species that we are now. So it's only, what, 3 or 4% of our existence that where we have had what we would call these modern religious views, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, modern religious institutions and structures, you know, obviously these contemporary ones over the last 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years drew on previous sort of forms and patterns. They didn't just emerge out of nowhere. You know, they weren't created de novo, but they became much more structured forms in that time period.
So if religion is recent as we know it, what did come before it?
Well, that's what I'm really interested in, right? And I would argue it's this capacity for belief, this capacity for meaning-making in the world. So over the last about 400,000 or 500,000 years, I mean, there's a little bit of evidence earlier, but it's really the last 400,000 or 500,000 years, members of the genus Homo, right, our direct ancestors and other populations that are sort of along the same trajectory but didn't make it to us, even though they may have contributed genetics to us. Over the last 400,000 or 500,000 years, we start to see the appearances of things like ochre, this sort of a mineral that's sort of like a pigment. If you add water to it or something, you can make paint your hands or a tool or a stick or something. We see carvings in ochre. We see ochre ground up. And then in the last 200,000 or 300,000 years, we start to see things like, you know, representations like beads and like little hash marks on different stones and cave walls. And in the last 100,000 years, we start to see stuff that we think of as symbol and art, right? Paintings of horses, you know, outlines of hands, and all of those amazing sort of expressions. But what's really interesting here is that meaning-making that is imbuing the world outside of our bodies, outside of our minds, sometimes even outside of the ability to see something with deep and significant meaning that affects how we behave and how we interpret the world, that's pretty old for humans, and that's what I'm interested in.
Professor Fuentes, just as a follow-up, among feminists, we often hear that in prehistory, patriarchy was not as strong. There were a lot of goddess, fertility, worship, that kind of thing. Do you believe that to be true?
Well, so, I mean, there's a lot of archaeological evidence to sort of look at that. But when you say sort of fertility goddesses and patriarchy as a structure, right, where we can like look in the bones and see different diets between males and females, where we can see, you know, archaeological remains that evidence different sort of gender roles or gender divisions, all of that is actually quite recent. That doesn't mean the last 8,000 to 10,000 years, that there was no difference between genders, or there was no gender at all, or there was no, you know, cases where there were sort of patriarchal or matrilineal or matriarchal structures. There probably were. It's just that they weren't formalized. So before this, it's not that there was some other type of religion that we recognize. It was a different way of being religious or experiencing religiousness. But, you know, things like rituals and structures and all those things were there. They just weren't formalized in the way we see them now. So, you know, a lot of people try to figure out what was it before the contemporary religions. Well, a lot of diversity in ways of making meaning and making sense of the world.
And I
all
bet
those ways.
Yeah. I bet that there were always people who didn't have that God gene too.
Well, I mean, and that's another thing. There is no God gene. You know, there is no genetic sequence that predisposes humans to a particular kind of religion. What there are genetic, neurobiological, social, historical, structural, you know, developmental processes that enable humans to believe and to sort of feel beyond the here and now. Now, what happens to that capacity, how that manifests in human societies and cultures and lives, that then is a really interesting story. And recently that has, you know, come to play in religions, in political and economic systems, and all those kinds of things.
So what about dreams and ancestor worship? You know, dreaming about dead ancestors, does that play a part of it?
So I think, I mean, and there's some suggestive evidence that some connection to death, maybe with continuity, sort of this ancestor notion, maybe not, is very early on, right? I mean, our earliest examples, some of our earliest examples of meaning-making are what look like depositions of dead bodies, right? At 400,000 years ago, at 200,000 years ago, and then the last 120,000 years, they become very common. So differential treatment of the dead with some sort of care or some sort of careful movement or placement in particular places. So we see that pretty deep in the past. It's not consistent. There's not a ton of evidence for it, but it looks like it's quite old, which means that death, life, death, meant something. But what it meant, there's no way. We can't tell what it means. And we're all biased now because we tend to associate, you know, life and death with, you know, either the Abrahamic religion, prophecies, or Buddhism, or particular forms of animism or ancestor worship, all of which are new, right, in evolutionary.
So we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we can finish this that conversation, but also we want to talk about agency detection in dreams of dead ancestors, and did that lead to ancestor worship. So we'll be right back with Professor Fuentes about his new book, Why We Believe, in a minute.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Princeton anthropology and primatology professor Agustin Fuentes about his book, Why We Believe, Evolution and the Human Way of Being. So, Professor Fuentes, or Agustin, si te puedo llamar por tu nombre.
Claro que sí.
Okay. We were talking about dreams of dead ancestors and also the idea that disembodied beings were imagined because of what we call agency detection, which you read about in a lot of books. What do you think about agency detection as part of the explanation for religion?
Well, so what happens is agency detection is one small byproduct of detached mental representation plus this experience of the transcendence that's centered in this capacity for imagination and belief. The problem is the people, mostly psychologists, who talk about agency detection have a very limited notion of what that transcendent experience is. They always try to make it in persons or agencies or causal factors. I think it's much broader than that. And I would argue that, yes, our ability probably to remember, to dream, I mean, many mammals dream. The real transition was the human ability to take those dreams and communicate them to others in their group and to maybe do something about it or to try to change their current reality because of those dreams. That's the sort of real significant thing for humans. And this agency detection, yeah, we frequently see things happen and try to explain them or figure out why. That's part of what humans do, and we've done that for a long time. But it's not all about spirits and ghosts and gods. A lot of that is also about this connection to the world. And we in the contemporary landscape try to force that into, you know, the religions or the ways we're familiar with. But we are just a little teeny slice of the diversity of ways of experiencing the world. And I think we shouldn't forget that.
So hearing you talk just now, you used the word transcendent or transcendence. And in your book, you use that word quite a bit. And I wasn't sure what you actually meant. Did you mean transcendent in the sense of something naturally transcendent, or are you saying that there is an actual supernatural transcendent realm out there that people through belief are connected to?
Well, for me, I really am not a big fan of the philosopher Kant, but Kant's notion of the transcendent was something that we feel and know to be true but can't explain at all. And so I'm using that word to evoke that feeling. I have no ability to detect whether or not someone has a wormhole connection to some other reality. That's not my, I'm a scientist. I can't ever test that. I can't look at that. What I can know is that when someone truly believes something or has this kind of experience that they feel that's more than the here and now, I can see that in their brain. I can see it in their heart rate, and they can tell me about how they feel about it. That's what I'm talking about.
So you're not talking about the supernatural.
No, because supernatural, I think, is a simplistic notion of this. I can't measure things that I can't feel or see, but I can listen to people and I can watch their bodies and see that they are real reactions. And that, for me, is really important.
Well, because the word transcendent can mean so many different things.
Yeah.
Music theory transcends a song. You know, I mean, there's all these different levels or categories or whatever you want to call them. So although when I was a believer, I really thought I was in connection with something transcending the natural world. And I got goosebumps and I got tears in my eyes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there is that there is that belief that a lot of people have. Since then, I've realized that it's all happening in the mind, in the brain. But
no, but it's not just happening in the mind. I mean, it is happening throughout your body, and it actually happens in connection with things that are not in your body, right? It's perception, the light coming in, the sounds, the experiences. What I'm trying to do is sort of point people to the fact that these are real things. Now, we explain them in different ways, and today we explain them in very limited and very specific ways. But I think it's really important to recognize how these experiences shape how humans feel and act and think about the world and each other. So belief, right, it's really important. I'm not arguing that for the rightness or wrongness of beliefs. I'm arguing for the capacity. Then we can ask about the beliefs themselves. And that's an important part.
Whether they're true or not.
Well, true or not is hard for some cases. I like to say, do they harm people or not? Are they damaging to societies? Are they taking away rights? Are they setting people up for trauma or violence or harm?
So I think the major thing I got from your book is the fact that these beliefs, whether they're religious or not, they all come from the same place, basically. And maybe it was in your book. In some books I've read that they've done studies of the brain, fMRI, when people are having religious experiences. And the parts of the brain that are firing are nothing different from the parts of the brain that fire when you have a normal conversation. So we're building on previous brain structures, and there's nothing new there, right?
So, I mean, the resting state, like when you're just mellow and doing nothing and just relaxed and not thinking, not meditating, not doing anything, just relaxing, your brain, that resting state is the same state as when you're interacting with people. So social, right? Social is the resting state of the human. We are never alone, even when we're by ourselves sitting calmly, because our mind is always built on these connections and others and what have you. That's really amazing. And that's a little bit where the supernatural agency detection comes from, because even when we're alone, our brain is like in communication, is doing the same things that it does when we interact.
So you end the book by saying that belief, whether it's true or false, is very motivating, and belief is important and even necessary to a better future, and you give a lot of examples of that, which makes a lot of sense. But what about negative beliefs? What about false beliefs? What about beliefs that cause people to do dangerous things? I mean, that can't be important.
No, I mean, it is very important. I mean, I think for me, there, like, the capacity to believe is something all humans have. How that plays out, that varies a lot. I mean, look at what's going on in the United States today right now. There are many people who believe things those very beliefs are harmful to other people, and they're acting on them. So I think belief is the most wonderful and most dangerous capacity humans have, and I think we see this played out. I think we can see, you know, take religion. I mean, you talk a lot about that. You can see many, 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 many negative things from institutional religions and particular theological orientations. But at the same time, you can also talk about individuals' connections with their own personal faith or one another or the communities in which they interact that have great potential benefits. So, I think we need to ask the questions like, what specific beliefs are we talking about, and what benefits or harms are they doing to the world?
I guess that for me, I don't think it's ever really a good idea to believe in something that isn't true, although I can see many exceptions. You know, somebody's dying and you don't want to tell them that somebody else, their child just died, or, you know, that kind of thing. You know, you want to...
But I mean, the truth is problematic here. There are many things that you can assess factually, but there are a bunch of things you can assess can't assess factually. So I'm more interested in, so what do these beliefs lead to, right? So my concern is, when you believe something, what does it facilitate happening? And I think there, because I'm interested in the practical, like what can we do? I'm very interested in how do we change beliefs.
So Professor Fuentes, let's look at, I mean, this is just a minute left or half a minute left. The stop the steal, for example, turned into a very dangerous belief.
Exactly, and it's a belief that's really held, and that's what people criticize this and call these people ignorant or, you know, fooled or something. But there's a whole central cohort of people who truly believe this, and look at the danger and the harm that's causing. I think we need to understand why and how they believe that, and how do we go about changing that belief.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Agustin Fuentes, for the book. The book is called Why We Believe, Evolution and the Human Way of Being. We barely scratched the surface, but listeners can dive into the book for a lot more evolutionary explanation for the origin of belief. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you, listeners, in Philadelphia to WOOM, in Madison, Wisconsin to WID and WMUU, Janesville, Wisconsin to WADR. Hello to listeners in Central Texas to KEOS, in Central Missouri to KOPN, in Eugene, Oregon, KEPW, in San Marcos, Texas, KZSM, in Vermont, New Hampshire, WOOL, and in Ithaca, Watkins Glen, New York, WRFI. If you're listening to the podcast, then please give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and tell your friends and family to find out more about Free Thought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org. You can click the Ask for Info link and get a copy of our newspaper and brochure. You can also go to the Donate and join us and support not only Free Thought Radio, but FFRF's vital work to keep religion out of government and social policy to support our secular constitution. Tune in next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday you'll join